Welcome to the Hunger for Change podcast, the podcast where we debunk all the health myths that we've all been led to believe from the industry for so many years while talking to the most brilliant, innovative, and sometimes controversial minds in the health field. I'm your host, Niklas Gustafsson, and today I'm thrilled to introduce our wonderful guest, Dr. Uma Naidu. Dr. Naidu is a physician known for being a triple threat in her field. She's a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, a professional chef, and a nutrition specialist. Her impressive work has led her to being regarded nationally and internationally as a pioneer in the field of nutritional psychiatry. She is the author of the book, This Is Your Brain on Food. Through her passion for food and nutritional psychiatry, she shares her expertise on the integration of food, mental health, and medicine. Join us as we dive into thought-provoking discussions on the latest discoveries in health that will expand our understanding of the human body. Please join me welcoming Dr. Uma Naidu to the show. I'm so excited. I really appreciate you being here with me today.
My pleasure.
So tell us, Dr. Naidu, first of all, what does health mean to you and what brought you to this field?
What brought me to this field is deciding to go to medical school. But what health means to me is, you know, the ability to live a full life and a joyous life. It's less about the numbers and the parameters that many people are often fascinated by in the United States. I think it's about the spirit of the life we lead and being able to wake up with a sense of hope and joy and abundance every day for whatever it is we do. I've seen that in people who do very different jobs for myself. And I've also seen people with amazing jobs that are very unhappy. So I think it's about finding that alignment within ourselves.
Right. And when you say parameters, could an example be like counting calories? Is that an example?
Counting calories or watching, you know, in the United States, we're obsessed with kind of counting calories and what's the number on the scale or how much protein are we eating? I think some of that is driven by the eat this, not that mentality, which I just don't agree with. So,
Yeah. Okay. So the holistic approach, that is what's more aligned with what you do, right? Yeah. So what do you say about recent research connecting diet to mental health? How is that related to mental health?
You know, the emerging evidence and the research around the gut-brain connection and the gut microbiome over the last decade and a half, almost two decades now, really started to show us that there was this connection between not only the gut and brain, but that also started to explain the food and mood connection. Now, eons ago, Hippocrates was onto this, but research and scientific study had to follow. And as we started to understand that there are these trillions of microbes that live in the gut that are involved in vitamin production, hormone production, sleep and circadian rhythm, immunity, mental health, and more, we began to understand that they also interact with the 95% or 95% of serotonin that's produced in the gut and the receptors for serotonin and other neurotransmitters that are in the gut. So we slowly started to understand that the gut and brain are connected. In addition to being connected, this science also helps us understand why food then interacts with the gut and impacts our mood, for example.
Interesting. So, for example, by some, gluten is seen as a toxin, right? And I'm a celiac. I've been celiac since birth. And since I was a kid, I've been reading about this, but it's not until the last like 5 years that I really understand what gluten is and how it's actually it's a toxin, because it's supposed to protect the seed, right? The wheat. So that it can get into the soil and become a plant. So, and I find it super interesting. I realized this when I was almost 50 years old. So now there's so much information about this, which we couldn't find when I was a kid. How would you say that the, how is gluten affecting our mental health and why?
Mm-hmm. So there are two parts to this answer. The first part is, I want to say, that gluten and wheat in the United States is very different from that in Europe and other parts of the world.
Yeah.
As an example, I have clients who may travel there for vacations, and work there for a while and come back, and they will literally tell me, I was able to eat bread in Bulgaria, I ate pasta in Italy, and it's, and let me clarify, they are not, they do not have celiac disease, but they were sensitive to gluten in the United States.
Yeah.
But they were able to tolerate it there because the type and quality of wheat is different. Mm. It's not as it is produced in the United States.
The amount of gluten is different, right? Depending on what kind of wheat you find.
That's right. The type of wheat that's been almost engineered in the United States is very different. Mm. And so a pure quality of wheat, they were able to tolerate and up to a point. And again, they didn't have celiac disease. Another thing that their clients have noted, actually even friends and family members, I go to Italy, I eat pasta, and I don't necessarily gain weight. Again, something in the United States, the idea is, oh my goodness, if you're going to have pasta dinner, it's, you know, it's kind of a weight producing. So a lot of things like that are very nuanced. The other factor is that in mental health, gluten has been shown to affect certain conditions, but that doesn't mean for the average person that I will say just exclude the gluten unless they have celiac disease or non-celiac gluten sensitivity, where they don't have full-blown celiac disease, but they still may be sensitive. Mm-hmm. But if it, I see an uptick of the anxiety and we can't find the cause, I might do an elimination to see if they could feel better.
Right.
Now, separate to that, people also, you know, have a very unique microbiome and people and could also respond differently for that reason. So I think it is nuanced. I try to not exclude too many foods with people because it starts to feel like they're eliminating stuff. Mm-hmm. And then when people feel they're eliminating foods and they feel restricted, they can't sustain it. Right. So that's why it's a little bit more careful how I do it. But we definitely have issues with gluten in the United States.
Right. Mm. And there's also this debate about the gluten or glyphosate, right? It could be a combination of both, or it could even be that you're not sensitive to gluten, but to glyphosate, right?
Exactly, that you could have the problems with the pesticides and how our crops are grown could also be the issue. And even that is probably affecting people that we don't even understand the mechanism yet.
Mm. Interesting. So, recently the experts, they call the microbiome our second brain. Why is that? And what role does our gut bacteria have actually on our mental health?
The gut bacteria play a very large role. But the reason that it's called the second brain is that the largest collection of brain cells and neurons outside of the brain itself is surrounding and kind of wrapping around the gut. Mm. And that's why it's called the second brain. The way that it's, let's break it down for a second. The gut and the brain originate from the exact same cells in the human embryo. They then divide apart and they form two separate organs, but they remain connected anatomically, physiologically, and biochemically throughout life by the 10th cranial nerve, which is the vagus nerve. And this nerve acts like a two-way text messaging system, sending chemical messages between these two organs. And earlier I said that, you know, 90 to 95% of serotonin and serotonin receptors on the gut. Understanding that, you start to put it together that these microbes are living in the gut. Most often the bacteria are the ones that are studied, but there are about five different types. They are microscopic. You cannot see them. There are trillions of them. But they interact with everything we eat. So on a day that I'm eating fast foods and processed, ultra-processed junk foods, or if that's been what I've been eating, those breakdown products are more toxic and to the environment of the gut and to the gut microbes. And the bad microbes start to thrive and start to set up inflammation in the gut. They also start to damage the single cell lining of the gut. And over time, those toxic substances start to cause things like leaky gut, intestinal permeability. Mm. And if I'm really trying to clean up my diet and I'm eating more healthy whole foods than processed foods, once I start to do that, you know, the breakdown products are actually positive in the gut environment, and they are called short-chain fatty acids. And those short-chain fatty acids fend off inflammation, they help the gut environment, and they help heal the gut. So there are some of these different pathways that we can, that's a very simplistic version of it, but it's meant to really convey that the breakdown of our food interacts with the microbes, and the breakdown products affect that gut microbiome.
Mm-hmm. So to stay away from junk food, that's important, right? To eat more whole food. What is it?
More healthy whole foods, yeah.
Right. So what is it? What ingredients are the worst ingredients in what we know as junk food?
Sure. So it's usually, there's been a lot of research done on these junk foods. So what they are is processed, ultra processed foods. And the ingredients in those foods are often synthetic. They are food stabilizers, colorants, dyes, thickeners, all of these types of things.
Yeah.
That's one aspect. Also, they have a lot of added sugar in some cases, extra sodium.
Seed oils.
Sir?
And seed oils, right? Vegetable oils, hydrogenated. Yeah.
Exactly. So hydrogenated seed oils, hydrogenated fats, seed oils, trans fats. The issue is that these are toxic ingredients to the gut. They cause inflammation. They're pro-inflammatory. But the other thing is that these foods, certainly in the United States, are engineered to make them hyper-palatable. Yeah. What that means is it taps into our cravings. So if I eat a bag of chips, I'm like, I could get another one. You know, I want more of that. So your brain starts getting tricked into craving more of that food.
Right.
So if you have that box of cookies in your kitchen, chances are you taste one, but you want to eat five more. And so we know that the way that food manufacturing works is really kind of working against us, unless you're actually eating just a whole food.
Right.
So those are some of the factors that start to impact the level of inflammation in the body. Now, inflammation is more and more being seen as an underpinning of conditions like depression, anxiety, cognitive disorders, and more. Therefore, it becomes so important, the selections we make. And it doesn't have to be perfect. We're just saying, for the most part, try to lean into those whole foods as best you can.
Yeah. So you mentioned that sugar, of course, it creates addiction. And that's why one of the reasons why they are actually designed in these products, right? In this junk food.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah. But apart from the addiction, what is it that sugar, how does it affect your microbiome?
So for one thing, sugar feeds the bad microbes, because in the gut environment, there are the good microbes that are there to help us thrive, help with all the positive functions in our body, but they're also bad microbes. They get fed by things like sugar and those unhealthy ingredients. When the bad microbes thrive, their breakdown products are toxic. They start to damage the gut lining. They start to cause inflammation.
Yeah.
And that's really a setup for longer disease. So I've had individuals who may come to me with anxiety and a skin condition. They may have some, say, acne that as an adult, they're wondering, why is my skin breaking out? And they also have, say, uptick of anxiety. And honestly, as we try and work to clean up the diet and move them towards more whole foods and less processed, ultra-processed foods, remove those vegetable and processed oils and trans fats and things like that. And slowly and steadily, I've had people not only improve their mental well-being, but physical well-being, such as, you know, their skin starts to clear and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it really is all, it's also connected.
Yeah, it's connected. So we all heard that the junk food is bad, and that we should eat more whole food. But if we go more into detail, what diet would you actually suggest that is related to less anxiety? Less anxiety, could you mention some, what are your personal favorites?
Sure. So I think that, you know, a lot of research has been done about the Mediterranean diet, and I agree with principles of that. But I think that a Mediterranean diet, so that it's more inclusive of different types of foods, like, for example, let's take chickpeas. Chickpeas are maybe part of a Mediterranean diet, but an East Asian culture may not eat chickpeas, but they eat a type of black bean or black soybean. So it's finding the right combination of foods that a person can eat within the guidelines of something like the Mediterranean diet, because it is actually encouraging healthy whole foods and, you know, a lot of vegetables, a lot of berries, nuts, seeds, the right type of oils from avocado and extra virgin olive oil and that type of thing. For anxiety, I honestly think it starts with cleaning up the diet as best we can. It doesn't have to be perfect, but even cutting back on, say, the soda. Or some people were drinking soda and they think, oh, let me get off the soda, I'll start to drink diet soda. This can worsen the anxiety. I'm not saying they shouldn't try and they shouldn't slowly come off the soda. The diet soda, the artificial sweeteners, worsen anxiety and can actually worsen symptoms overall. So that's another one that people don't realize. People often eat sugar and savory foods and they don't know it, like ketchup,
right,
pasta sauces that are store-bought, and salad dressings. Those are just three that many people will eat. They don't realize how much of sugar is in them. So in fact, there's a repository that there are, that's a list online, that there are 200, the last count that I checked, 262 other names for sugar on food labels, like
that's crazy.
Brown rice syrup. So,
yeah.
So it is problematic.
All to make it more difficult, right, for the consumer.
For the consumer to know that it's sugar.
To realize that it's sugar, right?
That's right. And
many of these products, they could have like eight different kinds of sugar. So you need to add them up, right?
You need to add them up or be aware that, you know, if the label is a big rectangle and it's full of ingredients you don't recognize, it's usually not good for you.
Right.
But I think the awareness, I think to your point, I think that's the next point you made. It's adding up those sugars and realizing I'm, you know, it may say sometimes it says, you know, low fat or has a label that appears healthy and tricks the consumer into thinking, oh, well, this is a good option, but actually it is loaded with sugar that you don't realize.
Totally. And so you mentioned, for example, ketchup and all these sauces, they do have sugar, but they also have glutamates, right? And glutamates can actually, as I understood it, they can also mess up your gut biome.
They can. And this is an interesting thing that is nuanced in mental health, because certain conditions, specifically studies in PTSD and OCD, so obsessive compulsive disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder, showed that even glutamates from natural foods can cause a problem for people. But there are also added glutamates and in food, and that can be problematic for mental well-being. Interestingly, the research has taken a stand and almost reversed some of the thinkings and the reasoning around MSG. So people are not as worried about that. But then glutamates on their own can even be found in natural foods, and that's why we have to be a little bit careful.
Yeah, I know that they can be found in natural foods, but what is the purpose? I didn't know that they could even be toxic to us, the natural ones. So what is the purpose of the glutamate in natural foods? What do they do?
You know, I believe that they're there for flavor, and they part of it is they unfortunately have these other problematic effects on our gut microbiome. Often they are just disruptive to the gut microbiome. You know, glutamates can be found in things like fish sauce, oyster sauce, tomato sauce, miso, that many people would eat routinely. These are not foods that are considered terribly unhealthy. So I think it's, you know, watching out for them becomes important.
It's important, yeah. Okay, so I saw that in your book, you also mentioned alcohol, right? And so I wanted to ask you, it's been a year now, almost a year, since I haven't had a glass of alcohol. I was preparing for an Ironman, a long triathlon, and that was in September. So it's from the 1st of August, I stopped. I wanted to see how my body reacted to that. So... And then actually I finished my Ironman, and then I realized that I wasn't really, I didn't feel like I was like to go back drinking again. So another week turned into a month, and 2 or 3 months turned into another few months. And so now it's been like about 10 months. So, and honestly, I don't think I will ever go back. And now I start to question myself, how come I drank alcohol during like 30 years? It's like, So that's I think that's really funny how your body actually starts to adapt to something that that's new to you. But and also I remember New Year's Eve I wanted to have a glass of champagne, and when I had my first sip, I realized that the strong taste of alcohol, which I hadn't noticed before, I then I thought probably that's the way kids feel the taste of alcohol for the first time they try alcohol, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I just found that so interesting. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So as an expert, what would you say are the benefits of eliminating alcohol from your point of view?
I think that if you are choosing to eliminate alcohol, certainly there's mounting evidence that it can be problematic in different ways, including to our brain. But I also feel like there are people who still consume alcohol. So giving them some guidance around moderation, right, clean cocktails, cutting back, you know, seeking help if it's a problem becomes important too. But, you know, the benefits are, I've had many of my patients say, well, you know, we're going through, say, an anti-anxiety protocol, and one of the things that they might notice is they have a glass of red wine every night to help calm them down to go to sleep. And what they don't realize is it's affecting their sleep architecture, yeah, and probably worsening the anxiety. So we start to slowly cut back on that and replace that with a warming, you know, golden chai in the evening or something that's more soothing to their system. And as they eliminate, like you experience, as they eliminate the alcohol, it's same thing with sugar, by the way, as people cut back on added sugars in food, they taste it and sugar feels very sweet or alcohol feels very strong. Or very different, and they almost have lost a taste for it.
Right.
I also think from a scientific perspective, they're almost in, they've kind of inhibited a little bit of a craving that may have begun in their body, and was driven by their brain. So I think that, you know, if you're choosing not to drink alcohol, you know, more power to you, because that's a good way to go if it works for you and it works for your body. What I find a little tough to do is take the stance that no one should drink alcohol, because I know many of my patients do, and I want them to follow the other things I'm suggesting to them. So I say, you know, have it in moderation. And if it becomes a problem, we might have to work on that in a different way. But, you know, can you, you know, be eating the vegetables, eating the other parts of the plan that I went to?
I mean, I think that's the same with sugar. You know, it's for someone that is consuming a lot of sugar, you know, having sodas, ice creams, cookies, then it's so hard to just from one day to another go cold turkey and leave it. I mean, then it's probably better to like reduce the amount of sugar, right?
Some people actually withdraw from it. So it is better to cut back over time and let your body almost detox from that load of sugar.
So what do you say about these superfoods? Or, I mean, when we talk about micronutrients, that could be called like superhero nutrients, related to mental health. What do you have any favorites? What could that be?
You know, I hesitate to make these favorites, and that's because people, for example, blueberries, super healthy berry, rich in anthocyanins, rich in antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties. I've had several people, in one instance, it was a mother and a daughter, have opposite reactions to it. One tolerated and loved it. Another one almost had a distaste for it, didn't like it, didn't agree with her. So even with healthy foods, we could run into problems. Another example is someone with IBS, IBC, Crohn's, SIBO, one of these conditions, ulcerative colitis, bowel conditions. Fiber is a super healthy nutrient that we want all our bodies to get. But for them, it may be problematic. It may be too uncomfortable for them to eat fiber, or eat, increase their fiber, I should say. So there are these nuances. I think that for me, the superfood is the one that really brings out your best sort of mental well-being. For some people, I love to ask them to lean into spices, because spices are calorie-free, sugar-free, salt-free, if you buy pure spice. They add flavor. They have brain benefits, turmeric with a pinch of black pepper, saffron, coriander, parsley, Mexican oregano, have different ingredients that are actually really powerful for your brain. Another group of foods that I like to talk about are prebiotic foods, because many people think, oh, they just have to get a supplement, but garlic, oats, bananas, jicama, Jerusalem artichoke, and more have prebiotic fiber, which feeds the microbes. So a lot of the food groups that I choose are actually, how can we amplify the health of our gut to help ourselves, because we started talking off about that gut-brain connection and therefore the food-mood connection. So that's why I want to have them eat those foods that are going to help them.
And when you talk about supplementation, I was listening to another podcast. You were, as a guest, you were talking about the that a lot of people actually in our society today lack magnesium, and they have low magnesium levels. First of all, why is that? Because I've heard other nutritionists and MDs talking about that. Why is that?
You know, I don't have an exact reason, because I think the research varies on this. I think it probably is largely comes back to the diet that we're eating, where we're just simply not getting enough of it. I think that's one of the reasons.
Too much junk food and too little whole foods.
Too little whole foods. And, you know, when we're eating whole foods, you're getting those vitamins and nutrients right in the food. So that, I think, is definitely one of the reasons. As to others, I'm not 100% sure. But many people in the Northeast are lacking vitamin D because of the level of our sunlight and the weather. So checking that with their doctors would be important, because supplementation is easy to do. Same thing with magnesium. If you're deficient, it's easy to do. And magnesium is one of the very powerful substances. It also eases anxiety. So it helps people sleep. It eases anxiety. So it does a lot of, plus it's involved in about 300 biochemical reactions in the body. So it's a good one to target.
So magnesium, you said D vitamin, vitamin D. Any other supplementation that you could like recommend in our society that we...
Yeah. So interestingly, saffron, which is a spice, of course, has...
An expensive one.
And an expensive one, and you don't use a lot of it. Has a lot of good evidence around improving mood. But in the studies, they used supplements because they needed a higher dose than what we would cook with. So that's an example of where I would say to someone, if you're struggling with your mood, maybe speak to your doctor about getting a clean supplement, you know, of saffron, because it could help you. So saffron is one, the magnesium is another to look at, vitamin D, a probiotic if you're going to take it consistently, because a lot of people take a probiotic for 2 weeks and then they forget to take it, and then all those positive changes are reversed. And then, you know, to think about fermented foods and, you know, other ways to bring in these live active cultures to your gut.
And what about tryptophan? Tryptophan that actually helps us boost the serotonin production. And on one hand, it can uplift our mood, right? And on the other hand, it helps us to sleep better, I believe.
So there's a lot of, there's even nuances about, so tryptophan, yes, it is definitely something that, you know, it's found in things like chickpeas. It can definitely help with mood over time. And in fact, in certain countries, it's sold, it has to be, it's more regulated, like in Canada, it's regulated in terms of people getting tryptophan. The nuance around tryptophan and sleep is that it's usually when it's paired with a carbohydrate source that that can be helpful. So I always joke that, you know, Americans talk about their turkey and mashed potatoes at Thanksgiving. It could be that the mashed potatoes are helping that kind of, after effect of eating the food and feeling more tired and things like that.
Okay, interesting. So what about artificial sweeteners? What is your take on artificial sweeteners? Because today, I mean, we see so many products that contain artificial sweeteners. Here in Europe, even like products that did not have artificial sweeteners 10 years ago, like soft drinks, like soda, I realized that when I went to a birthday party with my kids, they're small and they drink these soft drinks with artificial sweeteners, and nobody really knows about it. Nobody really cares. No.
Artificial sweeteners, unfortunately, have a negative effect on the microbiome. They can be quite disruptive. That doesn't mean you should never have them. I just mean have them in moderation. Don't be drinking every cup of tea or coffee or drinking every diet soda, because diet sodas contain them.
Yeah.
They also can actually trick the body into making you gain weight. Yeah. And the biggest effect is causing inflammation and disruption of the gut microbiome.
Right. So what is it exactly that they do to the microbiome?
The microbiome, I guess the best way to say it is they're kind of toxic to that environment of the microbiome.
Right.
Because they are substances that, for example, if you're eating an orange, you know, the vitamins, the minerals, the fiber is going to be broken down in the gut. There's a pathway for that to happen. But when you have an artificial sweetener, it's not really a food, right? It's a very processed.
Our body doesn't know what to do, how to digest them, right?
Doesn't recognize them. That's right. And it becomes, you know, more of a causing inflammation and disruption in the gut. So it's, you know, it's we also know that, like I said, it tricks the brain into thinking that sugar is coming. So it, you know, it disrupts that response as well and can cause people to gain weight.
Yeah. In your book, you talk about having different colors, fruit in different colors. Why is that? Could you please explain a bit more about that so we understand?
Yeah, so if you think about, you know, the carotenoids from carrots, the anthocyanins from blueberries or eggplant, the kind of bright, beautiful colors from different foods, these actually are also substances that are rich anti-inflammatory and have antioxidant properties. But they also directly interact with the gut microbes. So when the microbes help to break down these food products, the downstream products are actually very positive for the gut, like those short-chain fatty acids. So that's one mechanism by which these get broken down.
So I listened, I think it was a podcast I listened to also, where you were talking about ADHD. And a way to treat an ADHD patient is to reduce artificial additives, sugar and caffeine. What do you believe is most important to treat a ADHD patient when it comes to food and nutrition?
Right, I think understanding that gluten can be a problem for ADHD. Dairy can be a problem for individuals with ADHD, and that's why you'll see our milk cases now have A2 milk, because the A1 milk caseins can sometimes be problematic.
Not just the lactose, but also the casein.
Exactly. These additional proteins as well. And the things that are show up from the research in ADHD is that breakfast is a very important meal.
It is.
For people who suffer from ADHD. Mm-hmm. And that can be a problem, because sometimes the medications they take cause them to lose their appetite. So just encouraging that becomes important. They also show that a certain amount of caffeine was beneficial. So it's very nuanced for each person. It may not work for everyone, but it was a possibility for some people. And then going back to those polyphenols, which come from the berries, the cherries, the eggplant, the onions, the kale, the leafy greens, the green tea, all of these things are hugely important. And then vitamin C, vitamin B, zinc, iron, potassium, and magnesium were found to be nutrients that were helpful in terms of including into a person's dietary patterns or dietary habits.
What about meat? What about what kind of meat would you suggest?
Yeah, if people have access and they are eating meat, you know, pasture-raised eggs, pastured poultry, You know, pasture grass-fed red meats would be kind of ideal because in terms of eating those, you're getting a very quality product. But not everyone has access. These things can be very expensive.
Yeah.
So that has to be balanced up as well. There are a lot of studies saying, well, you know, if you eat red meat, your depression is going to be taken care of. And these studies can be a little bit polarizing of the opinion. Should we be plant-based or should we, you know, consume these? So I think it's about, again, finding the balance of what works for you and realizing that, you know, I feel a lot like when we fall into these rules, it can be more difficult for the person to sustain a good habit that they've made.
Yeah. And when we talk about red meat, it's what's important, I believe, is when you talk about the fatty acids. So if you have the grass-fed meat compared to the meat that is more like industrialized meat, then they're finished off before the slaughter. The animals, they have a lot of grains, they have soy, they have corn, right? And then they get a lot of omega-6, right? Which is more, which drives inflammation, etc.
Is that correct. So all of those drive inflammation and flip the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6. And when you have more omega-6, that really starts to set up for inflammation.
Right. So that's important to at least try to get a grass-fed meat, right? But you're right, it's much, much more expensive. So, yeah. But, I mean, maybe you don't have to eat huge amounts of... Perhaps it's better to eat, like, smaller amounts of grass-fed meat than eat lots of meat that is not grass-fed, right?
That's correct. Again, with kind of finding a way to enjoy in moderation and finding a way that you can sustain it as a habit.
Of course. So what about the ketogenic diet? I've heard you talk about it, that it can actually reduce your anxiety.
Yes. So there's definitely evidence to show that the ketogenic diet can help anxiety. It can be helpful in certain conditions. There's certainly case reports around bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. I think that the research is still young in this area and it's ever evolving. Mm-hmm. I think where it connects metabolic health with us, I think that's important. And I think that, you know, I think that in the appropriate case, appropriate patient, it's perfectly fine to offer them that as an option. I don't think it's one of my go-to tools, but it's something I feel I can counsel my patients about if and when needed. So one of the things I'll talk to them about is therapeutic carbohydrate reduction. So, you know, figuring out with the carbohydrates that you eat, which ones are lower on the GI scale, which ones are higher. Mm-hmm. And that way that helps to guide the process that we're going in.
So what is it actually on a ketogenic diet? What is it that actually happens in your body? Is it only about the sugar levels, that you reduce your sugar levels, or is there anything else that you would explain the benefits of a ketogenic diet?
Right. I think that my understanding is that what we want is nutritional ketosis, meaning that the brain starts to work on a different source of energy.
Yeah.
And that way you are actually promoting nutritional ketosis. And ultimately that helps with fat burning and, you know, just eating a healthy diet.
Yeah.
So I think there's definitely merits to it. What I feel is it's hard for people to sustain that diet. So if they wanted to try it, they've spoken to their doctor, they have a trial of a month, that's great. But I think it can get to be confusing for, you know, longer term, and you need a lot of structure and support to have it happen.
Mm. I agree. Actually, I've tried, I've been experimenting a lot with my own diet the last, I would say, almost 15 years now. And the ketogenic diet is something that is, as you say, hard to sustain during a longer time. So I was doing that for maybe 3-4 years, and I still like to be to be metabolically flexible, to be able to go in and out the ketosis, But it is hard to, I mean, I love fruit. And also the diet that I follow now is more like a carnivore diet with fruit and berries and raw dairy. But I completely understand what you say, when you say it's hard to do like for a longer time, right?
To sustain it.
Yeah, to sustain it, right? Yeah. Great. So I think we're actually about to wrap this up. Is there anything that you think that I should have asked you or that you would like to talk about that is interesting to bring up? Maybe something that in your book that you want to highlight?
So the book that I want to highlight is This Is Your Brain on Food. And I think that one of the things I want people to know is that there's a ton of recipes in the book in the last chapter. And these recipes are paired with every chapter so that you have the ingredients discussed in that chapter now added to a recipe. So I think people will find that interesting. And I want more people to realize that they can cook and they can cook at home, in addition to going out and enjoying a nice evening with your spouse or your friends and family. But I think that for me, it's, you know, putting together the conditions that make sense and where you need the help, and then learning to cook and setting up your kitchen is also super helpful to people, often coming from my own experience. So I think that can be useful.
Right. When you mentioned to cook at home, there is actually, I saw you were in a podcast talking about some of your patients. They were, during the pandemic, they were actually feeling better. They were feeling healthier. Could you please explain why? Because that was fascinating.
Yes. So I'll give you one example. I was working with a CEO before the pandemic. And part of the reason he was coming in to see me was he had experienced an uptick in anxiety. So he was on a low dose of medication by his primary care doctor, but he was more concerned and he wanted to get more information. And what we found is that he, as I got more information, you know, he was just had significantly changed his diet. He had he used to travel. I would say for 20 out of 30 days of the month. So even though he had a wife and a family and come home to healthy whole cooked meals, he was traveling and most of the time just on the go, on the run all of the time.
Yeah.
So I think just understanding that with COVID, he was at home and he and his wife started to do more cooking. She was always the primary cook at home, but he took an interest. He started to help order groceries online. And she cooked it in a healthy way. And he continued. And one of his appointments early on, he said, I don't know what to tell you, but I'm doing my scales, my rating scales to check my symptoms. And I'm feeling so much better. I didn't even realize it. Mm. And I really did assign it to that itself.
Right. I mean, it's when you cook at home, you can choose quality ingredients, right? But when you eat out, there is always these economic interests that make the restaurants pick the less healthier options. They're much cheaper, but they are less healthy.
They are less healthy, and restaurants are all about the food costing, right? So they choose the industrial seed oils or the vegetable oils that are pro-inflammatory and that they can use a lot of and sustain that. So that becomes it. Those nuances just become really important for us to know.
Totally. That's important to know when you eat out, that most of the times they're not going to pick the most expensive grass-fed butter or, you know, but seed oils. So thank you so much for your time, Dr. Naidu. Where can people find you that want to follow you and keep learning about?
Thank you. Go to my website and sign up for my newsletter, which I send out every week with a new food and new information and updated research. And you can find that at umanaidumd.com. If you want a free chapter of my book, you can go to gutbrainromance.com and download a free chapter. And you can follow me on social media, DRUMANAIDOO, which is at Dr. Uma Naidu. And again, on social media, you know, I share on updated research and the information around food and mood.
Great. We will add those links to this episode of the podcast, and so that people can find you easily. So, Uma Naidu, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. It's been so interesting to talk to you. I learned so much.
Thank you so much for great questions. It was lovely to talk with you, and I hope we can do it again soon. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to the Hunger for Change podcast. I also wanted to take a moment to talk about Naturally, my brand of healthy food products. At Naturally, we are on a mission to change the world through what we eat. This is why we worked so hard to make products that are delicious and also good for you. They're all gluten-free and have no refined sugar. My personal favorites are the cheesy snacks, chocolates, and cacao hazelnut spread. We also have kale chips, granolas, nut bars, nut butters, and protein powders, as well as many cool snacks to be released this year. At the moment, Naturally is only available in Europe. You can head over to our website, naturally.com, and it will take you to our online store. If you're in Italy, Portugal, Germany, Poland, France, the Netherlands, or Sweden, you can find them in Amazon. Search for Naturally. I will leave all of these links in the description anyway, so that you can find them. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.